Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
Last Tuesday's attack on Washington and New York united people across North America in feelings of shock and horror. Those initial reactions are giving way to a search for an appropriate response. For George Bush and his administration, and for many Americans and Canadians, retaliation is the only answer. For others of us, the best way forward is to seek to understand the root causes of the attacks. To help us with this task, we've contacted Karim H. Karim. He's acting director of the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton University. He's also author of the award-winning book, The Islamic Peril, Media and Global Violence, published last year by Black Rose Books. Karim joins me by phone from Ottawa. Hello, Karim.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Karim, how far back in history do you look to try to make sense of this particular attack?
I think that's a very interesting question because that's where the roots lie in history. I try to address this in my book because we have to understand how the whole impression that we have at the moment in terms of what Islam is, who Muslims are, cannot be separated from the long history of the contact between the Muslim Middle East and Christian Europe. We go back to the birth of Islam and the spread of Islam in the from Arabia to North Africa and places like Syria and then into Turkey. For a certain time, for 800 years, Muslims were in Spain. Of course, you know, I don't want to give you a full history lesson, but what I'm saying here was that there was a lot of contact at that time. And in many of these cases, not all, Muslims also traded and had cultural contacts, ongoing cultural contacts with Europeans, Christians. There were, of course, wars, and there was a strong tradition of developing a polemic, a critique of Muslims, which developed a whole number of stereotypes, whether it was about Prophet Muhammad or the other Muslims, and so on. And you will find these references embedded in medieval literature. In music, for example, in Mozart's The Abduction from the Seraglio, the paintings of the artists from the Romantic period like Ingres, Delacroix, and others. So what you have is a cultural memory of Islam, which is then, as we come closer to the period of colonialism, is used by colonists to depict a culture which is seen as backward, as given primarily to violence, to greed, barbarism, and so on. And it becomes easier to dominate a group when you have developed these kinds of images, because what you are telling your people back home is that we have to carry out these wars abroad and conquer and subject these people to ourselves, because these are bad people. And we have to teach them civilization and the correct religion and so on. So this kind of polemic then continues into the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries. After this, of course, you had the Cold War, in which generally the enemy was seen, of course, as Eastern Europe, the communist Eastern Europe. At the end of the Cold War, you have the rise of these images again. It's been sort of, you know, a historical period in which, a historical memory in which these images are embedded and can be sort of resurrected because they still lie in Western literature and can be, you know, read in that way, in a negative way.
What are some of the causes of the resentment against the U.S. in particular, against Americans or against America?
Well, you know, I'll sort of try and get this in a circular way, but I'll answer your question. some of the headlines that I've been seeing and some of the writing in the media has been that America has finally lost its innocence. Interestingly, this is exactly the term that was used when the Oklahoma bombing took place in the federal building there. There was this image, you might remember it, of a fireman who saved a baby who was badly burned. And the headline said, America finally loses its innocence. It seems that America keeps losing its innocence. Basically, I think the myth of America as innocent is extremely resilient. It's something that they reproduce through their media, through the discourses, and so on, which does not enable them to see their own actions abroad properly.
Why do you think this myth is so persistent? I mean, I think we've seen that even, you know, after Vietnam, through Watergate. It does seem to be a very resilient and persistent myth.
It's part of the self-image of the Americans, because anyone who's lived there will tell you that there is this self-image of America the good, America the innocent, that their actions abroad are benign actions, that they mean good for everyone. Even though they send their armies abroad, they send their navies abroad, they launch various missiles at people, they bomb people, they assist in various coup d'etats, they install dictators, etc. There still persists a very, very strong self-image of this kind, because it serves them well. It allows them to ignore these crimes abroad. I mean, it's the only way you can describe them, which in a way I think is part of. There's nothing, you know, there's no two ways about it. It is a propaganda system, which enables, just like I described earlier, that among the colonists, you had to describe the other as bad, as evil. So in this way, if you keep describing yourself as the innocent, the good, you can keep doing whatever you want and still be seen by your population, by your citizens, as good, as following, you know, a moral path. And so, you know, they keep voting you. The same elites are voted in over and over again. It has served the American elites extremely well.
Karim, during this past week, as everyone's attempting to come to grips with this very terrible situation, terrible tragedy, the Canadian media have concentrated almost exclusively on coverage of the attack. What do you make of the kind of coverage that you've seen and read?
Well, there has been some sort of nuance every day that's developed. Initially, of course. Especially the television, we were constantly seeing the same pictures over and over again. These were very dramatic pictures. The very nature of the incident, I mean, usually when a terrorist incident occurs, the cameras arrive long after the explosion or whatever has occurred, and, try to capture, ambulances and police cars and detectives and so on coming by. What we saw on Tuesday, a lot of us saw the pictures live. This created a tremendously dramatic scenario, a huge psychological impact. So that had to be captured on the first day, and it was. There was hardly any. What we were seeing were buildings and destruction of large scale. The focus didn't seem to be on the people. The next day, the focus seemed to shift on the victims, on the people who died, and then later on the families and so on. Now, there was also another kind of progression in that initially, and I was quite impressed by this, because in the past there has been a tendency to start speculating on who carried out the act. There was some restraint in the morning and in the early afternoon, but by the evening, what had happened was that the various commentators who were invited, the so-called experts, basically started saying that this person, usually Osama bin Laden, was the person who'd done it, and so on. without much evidence. Now, he may turn out to be the person. However, you would expect that, you know, these kinds of people whose advice is being sought, whose knowledge is being sought, would base their speculation on fact. There were no facts available at that point. You saw the same thing happening when the Oklahoma City bombing took place. People started speculating this is a Muslim terrorist act and so on, and a lot of Muslims did get attacked. The same thing is happening now when, you know, a whole group of people, Muslims or Arabs, get blamed, and you have incidents of people being, slurs being hurled at them, or people being attacked physically and so on. And this is the responsibility that the media bear, the journalists bear. They have to be extremely careful about how they describe people, how they lay blame. It is very important to be very, very precise in terms of who is responsible for these things.
What do you make of some of the columns that have been written in the national newspapers in Canada with commentary on the situation?
Well, there's been a variety of material, and I think by and large, there has been the variety consists of, on the one hand, you will have some introspection. I was just, reading the Ottawa Citizen just a few minutes ago, and one of the commentators, one of the editorial writers, had suggested that we distance ourselves from American foreign policy, which was, I think, an interesting approach, but one of the exceptions. What most editorial writers have tended to do is join in with the war drum beats, trying to sort of say, okay, how are we planning this? Who shall we hit? When shall we identify the culprits and so on? There seems to be lacking, on the whole, a kind of reflection, a kind of rational thought, which is very important at this time. One of the editorial writers, one of the commentators in the Globe yesterday, basically said that this is very strange, why should people do this to America? Again, using the theme of America the Innocent and saying America has finally lost its innocence. She said the war in Iraq was what she called a cartoon war in which hardly any blood was shed. Now, this came as a huge surprise to me, because even by conservative American estimates, about 200,000 people died during the war, and due to the destruction of the infrastructure in the country, 500,000 children under five died in the years following. So to call it a cartoon war, to deny the responsibility of the American government abroad, I think is a huge mistake. So there has been a whole variety of responses, but I think the majority have not tended to provide the kind of distance, the kind of reflection that we need at this point.
All indications seem to be that the Bush administration is going to lodge a military attack, possibly off on Afghanistan, in an attempt to eradicate the threat posed by terrorists. Now, you've written extensively on terrorism. What would be the likely outcome of this approach?
Well, when you think of the kind of bombing that That Americans have carried out before, whether it was in Iraq or in Vietnam, in Laos, Cambodia, and other places, what really does that achieve? Let's say they are correct in identifying Osama bin Laden, that the Taliban government in Afghanistan, which is a very repressive government, of course, is responsible for these things. Let's say all that is true, and that they carry out, basically, they destroy all the people responsible. Does that, in effect, eliminate terrorism? Do we think that we can solve this problem through military means? These are the kind of questions that the American administration and our government, and you know, NATO has sort of put itself behind the Americans. These are the questions that these governments should be asking themselves. Does war, does military might solve these kinds of situations, these kinds of problems? Are we seriously interested in global peace? You know, apart from gold and oil, the two other, the only other stocks that went up in the few hours that the stock markets were open on Tuesday was those of armaments industries. There is a lot at stake here in terms of the economics of it. The Americans made a lot of money after the American armaments industries made a lot of money after the Gulf War, which was basically, in one way, an advertisement for American armaments manufacturers. So if we were really interested in global peace, I think other means would be adopted, human means rather than military or technological means. If we really wanted to reach out and understand what are the causes of this, why do human beings hate America so much? Why do those human beings? What leads to someone to you know, when I was watching the plane fly into that building, I was trying to put myself in the place of the pilot. What sort of a human being can have so much hatred and so much conviction that this is the right thing to do? There must be a tremendous feeling of threat on this on the part of this person, feeling that America or that symbol of America posed a threat to himself, to his community, and to his worldview. Now, these are the questions that American and other policymakers should be thinking. Why does this exist? What has America done abroad, or what does the West stand for as a total entity out there in the rest of the world? And this is something that we should work on. Now, to its credit, the Canadian International Development Agency, one of the programs that they do have is to work on developing civil society institutions in countries like Pakistan, which is, of course, right next to Afghanistan, and which in itself has a strong Islamist, or what is often called a fundamentalist Islamic movement. Now, by encouraging the growth of debate, the growth of alternatives within their own cultural perspectives, this is perhaps the way to go about resolving the bigger problems. It'll take time, take effort, it'll take a sincere attempt to understand what the bigger problem is. Bombs will not solve the problem.
Back here at home in Canada, Muslims are starting to, you know, feel some heat, to be scapegoated, to be detained at airports, insulted, threatened. I believe there was a firebombing in Montreal. What response do you think is appropriate for non-Muslim Canadians?
Yes, these incidents have happened, and in a way, these were almost predictable. I think, first of all, the Prime Minister, right, you know, from the word go, should have recognized that this is going to happen, because it's happened before during the Gulf War. I think what has happened since then is that, to his credit, the Prime Minister, as well as George Bush, I understand, has spoken about these things and has basically given out the word that Canadians and on the part of the Americans that they should not take vigilante action. This is not a war against the people who live in Canada and in America. Not all Muslims, obviously, are responsible. Now, what has also happened is that certain church groups, certain organizations like university organizations, have put the word out there, which is of a similar kind, that, you know, we value the citizenship and the neighborliness of our Arab and Muslim compatriots. This is to be distinguished. They are to be distinguished from the people who've carried out these acts. I think it is important for leaders, for people who are opinion makers, for institutional leaders, to keep making these statements, and of course the media themselves need to make people aware that in this time of the raw feelings, the raw emotions that people have, and the anger, not to turn it on ourselves, on our own populations, that there is a time for mourning, there's a time for healing, and we should be looking at working together to resolve this problem.
Karim, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're most welcome. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Karim H. Karim. He's Acting Associate Director of the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton University. He's also the author of the award-winning book, The Islamic Peril, Media and Global Violence, published last year by Black Rose Books.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.